Everybody, and welcome to the Thursday, May 28th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. Members, Senator Boquist is excused. He had to go deal with a personal emergency. And you might also notice that Aaron Seiler, our committee administrator, has morphed into the very capable and experienced Sandy Thiele Sirka, who's going to be filling in just for today because House Rules is meeting right now, too, and Erin couldn't be in two places at once, as remarkable as she is. If there is anybody here in the audience for House Bill 2655A, we are awaiting paperwork on that that has not come through, and so we will not be taking that up today. That bill is being carried over to our next hearing, so you don't need to hang around for that. And everything else, I think we will be at least taking testimony on. So I will start by opening a public hearing and work session on House Joint Memorial 20. And Sandy, could you tell us what this is?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, HJM 20 urges Congress to fund and maintain the United States Coast Guard Air Facility at Newport, Oregon in perpetuity.
Thank you, Sandy. And I see that Representative Gomberg has joined us, if you'd like to come forward. Did you have anybody you were planning to bring with you? Ah, great.
Jenny.
Uh-huh. Are you Jenny Goldfritz?
I am.
Great.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For your record, I am David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast. And I will apologize in advance if I depart immediately after sharing a few thoughts with you. As you well understand, we have things going on in several different parts of the building. I'm needed for a quorum down in room F. I would not be surprised if Senator Roblin and Representative Boone join us at some point, since they are very involved with this piece of legislation as well. House Joint Memorial 20 deals with the Coast Guard Air Station on the Central Oregon coast, one of three that we have based here in Oregon. And it is a memorial to Congress, and I'm not generally a huge fan of memorials to Congress, but I believe in this case we have a measure that that is meaningful and can make an important difference. The subject is the U.S. Coast Guard, and in my district, we celebrate the United States Coast Guard. We honor the men and women of the Guard who go into dark and dangerous waters to save strangers, and there is no greater calling than that. But somewhere, somehow further up the chain of command, someone has decided that saving money is more important than saving lives. And I say that to you because at some point last year, we received the startling news that the Coast Guard Air Station based in Newport would be closed. Closed with a mere 60 days notice. And I will tell you that the response to that news was immediate, and it was unified up and down the Oregon coast. There were huge town hall meetings. There were petitions that generated over 18,000 signatures. We had the involvement of our congressmen and our U.S. senators. Lawsuits were filed. And eventually, the decision was at first postponed for a month and then postponed for a year. And now, thanks to our congressional delegation, we have a measure which is before the U.S. Congress saying that this air station should be reinstated permanently. And that, of course, is the subject of the measure before you. We're here to ask you to support it because it's important to my constituents, and I think it's important to your constituents as well. My district is home to the largest commercial fleet in Oregon. And the basis of the Coast Guard decision was that they had identified a national response standard to emergencies, saying that if we can get to people within 2 hours anywhere in the country, that would be adequate and life-saving. But my commercial fleet will tell you that the waters off Newport, Oregon are very different than the waters off Newport, Rhode Island, or the waters off Newport Beach, California, and that 2 hours in the cold waters that we experience here are essentially a death sentence. They will tell you that even in life-saving equipment, that we cannot sustain a two-hour wait for help. They'll tell you that they have lost loved ones, that they're concerned that they will lose more. And that is an important reason for their unified response to this challenge. My district is also the home of the largest charter fleet in Oregon. We have, on any sunny summer afternoon, thousands of visitors go into the water in small boats to go fishing, to go crabbing, or to watch the whales. These are usually more often your constituents than they are mine. And very seldom do they have any training at all in rescue equipment or life-saving suits or locator devices. And in these cold waters, after a mere 20 minutes, these people, should they find themselves in trouble, will not even have the strength to call out for help or to raise an arm to signal for help. Our beaches are also some of the most popular in Oregon, and we consistently find ourselves in situations where people are caught in sneaker waves. They're caught on the rocks with the tide coming in. They are in harm's way. And during our public hearings previously, we had a large number of first responders in the audience who talked about the fact that when people get into trouble on the beach, that these groups need to make life and death decisions about their own staff, their own paid staff, their own volunteer staff, on whether or not they send people into the water to aid those in trouble if they don't have the Coast Guard there to support them. And the Coast Guard is making numerous life-saving trips for people that are visiting from all around Oregon, all around the Northwest, all around the country. And interestingly enough, we also heard testimony from the forest products industry, because the Coast Guard is often called upon to go into to terrain which is very difficult to reach otherwise, and to bring out forest workers who have sustained injuries and need help. So this is a very broad subject matter. One point that I found particularly interesting is of the three air stations in Oregon, one in Astoria, one in Newport, and one in North Bend, that only one is outside the tsunami inundation zone. And so what we're saying is that when, not if, but when a major seismic event strikes us here in Oregon, that we're going to close down the only air station that has the potential to still be operational on the Oregon coast at a time that we're going to need them very seriously. So interestingly enough, this measure went through the House Rules Committee, went to the House floor, passed in the morning. And in the afternoon, the U.S. House of Representatives passed their measure. It's an interesting timing. I'm anticipating that things are moving very quickly in Washington, D.C. I hope that you'll move this measure forward quickly, that it will find itself on the floor of our House, and hopefully that afternoon it will be on the Senate floor in Washington, D.C. and pass again. Nothing would make me happier. We need to see this measure move forward. I don't often use phrases like a matter of life and death, but the Coast Guard saves lives, and their absence will cost us lives, both for my constituents and yours. So I appreciate you taking a few minutes to hear those thoughts, and I'd like to introduce somebody else who has a similar perspective. Great. And again, I may excuse myself and get back to another committee where my vote is needed. So thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Representative Gomberg, for your work on this, and please go ahead.
And my name is Ginny Goblersch. I'm from Newport, Oregon, and I'm past president of the Newport Fishermen's Wives Association, and I'm a member of the fishing industry. I'd just like to thank our congressional people, our senators, state senators and representatives, and the state of Oregon through the legislative body for taking this up. This is very important to all of us. We've had, when we were looking into figures of activity with the Coast Guard, over the last 5 years, over 4,000 interactions with helicopter being involved in saving lives. And most of those are from out-of-town people that come and get in trouble. So that means people from other counties and other states. We, of course, were totally shocked at the Coast Guard's announcement. I, for one, was involved way back when the helicopter first came to Newport. And it was the same reason then as it is now, and it's time. Time and temperature make all the difference. The Coast Guard did not, upper command, let's say, did not dial in the new cold water research that was done in the 90s, if you can believe it, into their standard, which would make this whole exercise moot. And why they didn't dial it in, I don't know. Probably all their other pressing business that they have now that we certainly understand. But at some point, I just feel like people have to say, enough's enough. We're talking about basic search and rescue, nothing fancy, one helicopter, and that's badly needed on the coast. It's needed now more than ever. We've had such an increase. So when I went back to D.C., the one thing I heard was that the voice coming from Oregon was so loud they couldn't ignore it, that people that had nothing to do with the state of Oregon had heard how many people were writing and calling and signing petitions. And I met with the Coast Guard, and they did too. They said, we've heard you loud and clear. That's all they'll say. But so to keep the pressure on, to keep the voice going, this is what we're doing, and making a statement from this body would be great, from the legislature, would really help, and we appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions? Okay, I don't see any questions for you, so we'll let you go. And I think that completes our sign-up sheet. Senator Roblin is a chief sponsor but was not able to be here. He definitely is urging us to move this quickly, and hopefully it will get the same attention from the U.S. Senate that the House got from Congress. So, Senator Farrioli.
Madam Chair, I move HJM 20 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Senator Farrioli has moved HJM 20 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, motion carries. And we'll ask Senator Roblin to be our carrier on the floor, and I'll close the work session on HJM 20. And I think we might as well just move up to the top and start with our first bill.
Okay.
So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 966. And Sandy, would you tell us about this one?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 966 requires the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to develop and administer or enter into a contract with a private entity to develop and administer training programs for members, administrators, or directors of boards, commissions, and small entities of the executive departments. It lists the requirements of the training program. It requires each new member and new administrator, director of a board, commission, or small entity of the executive branch to attend this training within 6 months of the start date of their service in the particular department. It has an emergency clause effective on passage. You have a minimal fiscal impact on the bill and no revenue impact on the bill, Madam Chair. And no amendments at this time.
Great.
None that I know.
Okay, and thank you, Sandy. I think we have Barry Pack from Department of Administrative Services here to testify on this member. You'll remember that we introduced this just recently as a committee bill from our committee, so it should look a little bit familiar to you. And Mr. Pack is going to tell us more about how it would work.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Barry Pack, Deputy Chief Operating Officer with the Department of Administrative Services, and thank you for introducing this bill and hearing it today. I think Sandy did a great job of explaining the basics of it. I'll just hit a couple of points in addition and then be available to answer questions. One thing I wanted to point out is the definition in Section 1 of small entity. While we have 312 boards and commissions, Legislative Council told us there was no real comprehensive definition of a board or a commission that would bring in folks, each of those, in a comprehensive way. And then we began thinking about where the risk really was in terms of some of the accounting and budget and management issues that occur in some of these small boards and commissions. And so we narrowed the bill to look at these small entities. These are agencies or departments or programs that have fewer than 50 FTE. There's about 30 of them that will be covered by the bill. Secondly, the bill does outline specific areas for the training to cover ethics, restrictions on political activity, public records, public meetings, and then gives us the latitude to look at operation and management of boards, commissions, and small entities. And for us, that's really following accounting rules, following personnel policy and rules, helping with budget education and training on how to develop and execute a budget. And then finally, the point that I wanted to make is that a lot of this material exists in prior training. We used to offer training more regularly to board and commission members. We stopped doing that as part of budget cuts when the Great Recession hit. But those curricula still exist out there. They just need to be dusted off. They need to be coordinated. And we have other partners in the executive branch, namely the Department of Justice and the Ethics Commission, for instance, who already provide training, have it available, have trainers trained, ready to do this work. And so we'll be partnering with them to coordinate this curriculum and the delivery of the training for the folks that are required to take it in order to serve on a board or commission, rather than trying to recreate the wheel and go to a lot of additional expense or work. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you for stepping up and being willing to take on this responsibility. It's something I think our committee and Kendall Klassen, when she was here, the executive appointments person for the governor, had been thinking was needed for a long time. So does seem timely. And are there any questions?
No, but Madam, just for the legislative intent record, the outline of the training is just exactly what I had hoped it would be. So that's, I'm very supportive of that. The boards and commissions can be as different as they can possibly be because of the breadth and depth and scope of the voluntary organizations that we rely on to help govern the state of Oregon. But I'm hoping there'll be some mission-specific interactions as these trainings go forward because I have the sense after talking to and meeting with appointees for decades almost now that many of them are so overwhelmed by the honor and the opportunity to serve, they never really get to the idea of what am I supposed to do when I get there. And the assumption that we all make is, well, board members will rely on each other, you know, and they'll move forward. And if they have specific questions, they'll ask staff. Or the executive director of the agency will help educate those committees. And that is precisely what needs to be pushed against. Because the last thing I want to see is continuation of a corporate culture where board members don't realize that their function is to set the policy direction for the agency, sometimes in concert with the legislative intent of laws, sometimes in the rulemaking process, but frequently with no direction other than a series of alternatives that may be presented by the staff or the executive director of the commission. Those alternatives can't be the same choice presented in three different ways. And it has to be a matter of the board members themselves insisting that they have a strong management role to play in the direction that the agency or small entity goes. So, you know, it's really a matter of, I think, giving empowerment to the people so that they can serve to the best of their ability, but to the benefit of the citizens at large. It's a tall order, but I think what happens often is that people just get inculcated into the corporate culture and bump along, and essentially a lot of decisions that could be proactive are defaulted to. So the intent that I hope to make clear for the record is this is meant to empower members of boards and commissions to take a far more active role in directing the actions of agencies. Thank you, Madam Chair, for that.
Great. Thank you for that excellent explanation.
Madam Chair, may I just, and Senator Fairley, a bit to your point, Senator Boquist had asked that we include in the bill provisions around providing online training, and so there is a section in there for that. However, we envision the value of this training really to be in that sort of interactive dialogue where we can have those conversations and provide mission-specific answers to questions like that. So we'll be probably doing a basic 101 online that anyone can take at any point in time, and then there'll be a classroom-led portion for that dialogue to occur.
Great. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And that completes our sign-up sheet. I'll close the public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 966. Senator Farioli?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 966 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. Move Senate Bill 966 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. Senator Farioli, you spoke so eloquently about this. Would you like to carry it on the floor?
Madam Chair, I thought you wanted the bill to pass. I'd be happy to carry it.
Okay, great. We will ask Senator Farioli to be our carrier, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 966. And how about if we just keep going in order?
Sure.
Okay, and I will open a public hearing and work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 16.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Concurrent Resolution 16 recognizes and honors Specialist Mabry James Anders from 1991 to 2012 for his service to the state.
Okay.
I'm not sure who we have.
This actually came from the Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness, and as I said at the outset, Senator Boquist was called away, or I think would have been testifying on this today, so we don't actually have anyone signed up to testify. Members and those who might be listening at home can read this for themselves, but maybe I'll just read the last couple of paragraphs. That whereas Specialist Mabry James Anders received awards and decorations, including the Bronze Star Medal, Purple Heart, Army Achievement Medal, Army Good Conduct Medal, National Defense Service Medal, Afghanistan Campaign Medal with Bronze Service Star, Global War on Terrorism Service Medal, Army Service Ribbon, Overseas Service Ribbon, NATO Medal, Combat Action Badge, and Driver and Mechanic Badge, as reported by the United States Army. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Legislative Assembly of the State of Oregon that we, as members of the 78th Legislative Assembly, recognize and honor Specialist Mabry James Anders for his service to this state. And there's a lot of other good information in here, too. He obviously was a very brave hero whose life was cut short too soon. So, yes, and he grew up in Baker City. So, we are in a work session, Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, having the honor to represent Baker City and Baker County, and also the town of Haines, where this military veteran was buried with full military honors. It's my honor to move SCR 16 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Farioli has moved SCR 16 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. And Senator Farioli, would you or would Senator Boquist?
Madam Chair, I'll confer with Senator Boquist, but I'd be honored to co-carry or to carry.
Great. Okay, well, we'll list you as the carrier, and then you can work it out with him. And I'll close the work session on SCR 16 and open a public hearing and work session on House Joint Memorial 20.
17.
Oh, I'm sorry. We did that one already. I'll forget that. I'll open a public hearing and work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 17.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Concurrent Resolution 17 is a memorial to Hector McPherson Jr., born 1918, passed away 2015. And we have a couple of individuals to testify.
Great. Okay, I'll call them both then. Meredith Shield and Peggy Lynch, if the two of you would like to come forward.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Meredith Shield, and I have the honor of working with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. 1,000 Friends works to enhance Oregon's quality of life by building livable urban and rural communities, helping out with family farms, and conserving natural areas. Thank you for hearing SCR 17, a resolution honoring Hector McPherson. Everyone who loves Oregon owes tribute to Hector McPherson Jr., who, as noted in obituaries and honors across the state, passed away earlier March 20. 21st, 2015. So often guests who visit Oregon remark on the farmland that dominates the Willamette Valley landscape, both praising its personality and its economy. As a pioneer legislator who helped lead the movement for rational land use policy in Oregon, and the person most closely associated with defending world-class farmland, Hector changed the path of development by reminding us what should not be lost to subdivision. The resolution before you recognizes Oregon's innovative system of land use planning implemented through Senate Bill 100 under Hector McPherson's leadership. It recognizes that Hector provided critical protection for farmland and forest lands and established statewide planning goals, distinguished the state as a leader in smart growth that has resulted in most livable neighborhoods with easy accesses to parks, schools, libraries, and other amenities. The greatest honor we can pay to Hector is to continue his work. In his words, a new generation of leaders must find a way to balance the need for public and private gain that is acceptable to the majority, and I hope I am one of those people and look at Hector as a leader in that. Together, we carry his work forward, and thank you for the opportunity to honor such a great Oregonian.
Great, thank you for your testimony.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Peggy Lynch. Although you will see me around the building as representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon, today I am here as just an Oregonian. Sometimes there are ordinary people who by their very actions become special people, leaders by their actions, and Hector McPherson was one of those for Oregon. Generations before 1973, since 1973, and those forever after will be thankful that he stepped up to be a part of a bipartisan leadership to protect our farms and forest economies while assuring we had vibrant communities. His vision of an Oregon continues today. We are sometimes very lucky in this building to have special people who simply step up and say, I see something that needs to happen, and I'm going to help it happen by working with others. I was very lucky to have known Mr. and Mrs. McPherson for a number of years as I worked on land use issues and watched when Governor Kulongoski provided a bouquet of roses during their 50th wedding anniversary a number of years ago. And they lived and Mr. McPherson lived his last years in Corvallis, where I could see him taking his daily constitutionals around the neighborhood. He will be missed, but I, for one, will be forever thankful that he graced this earth and took the time out of his busy life to serve Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you both for your testimony. Are there any questions?
Comments, Madam Chair?
Comments. Yes, go ahead, Senator.
No, I think the story is a singular, it's a singularity. There was a duality to the story because there was another chapter, Stafford Hansel.
That's correct.
And you could make a really strong argument, I think, that without the partnership between Stafford Hansel and Hector McPherson, we wouldn't have had the broad-based support for Senate Bill 100 that was evidenced back in 1973. It was revolutionary, and it was an experiment. It was openly acknowledged that it was an experiment. It's something that people have worked very hard to maintain, and we have to work hard today to maintain it because sustainability is the question. Not all the outcomes promised by Senate Bill 100 have been accomplished. We don't have healthy forests. We don't have sustainable rural agriculture in the way that I'm certain that it will be sustained as it was when Mr. McPherson and Mr. Hansel envisioned it. A lot of consolidation has occurred. A lot of the smaller family farms and ranches have been impossible to be sustainable just because of the economics of agriculture and animal husbandry. So we've entered an age where consolidation is common in all of the sectors. And the question is, if we could look forward to the same period that we've come in land use planning, what will we see in Oregon? And what I'm hoping we'll see is sustainable farms and ranches, healthier forests, more resilience in ecosystems and rural communities that are economically sound. Today, our rural communities are in deep distress. A lot of the objectives of Senate Bill 100 have found expression in such restrictive land use patterns that those communities that are losing population on the east side of the state of Oregon are now really having difficulty maintaining basic services. So it's time for us to refocus on the objectives and re-embrace and re-energize our commitment to the objectives, but realize that in order for any system like this to continue to be successful, it simply has to be flexible to accommodate the conditions that we find ourselves in today. But this is a completely fitting concurrent resolution, and I notice, Madam Chair, the rather impressive population of co-sponsors that are on this bill. Everyone wants to be part of the celebration of Hector McPherson's legacy. So I think that speaks volumes about what he's done and what his vision is. And I hope we're worthy of the task of maintaining that legacy as we move into the future.
Thank you for your comment, Senator Farrelly. And you're right, every single member of the Senate has signed on as a sponsor of this resolution, and many members of the House as well. I had the opportunity to meet Hector McPherson, but just briefly to shake his hand, but certainly have known of his work and his legacy for a long time. I didn't know that he had been a navigator flying bombing missions in World War II, which my dad was also. My dad was a little bit younger than he was, but that was actually heroic service as well. But certainly his name is well known to people who cherish the quality of life in Oregon, and particularly his crowning achievement of being known as the father of our statewide land use planning system, which, though it's had twists and turns and certainly always needs to be updated, has served as a model to the nation. And then I think, and I don't know if Greg McPherson is listening to our hearing today, but having served with one of Hector's children, Greg McPherson, as we all did, that legacy has been carried on just very vigorously and brilliantly in the service of Greg McPherson when he was a legislator and now as a member of LCDC. And so that is also a tribute, I think, to his legacy. So, Senator Burdick, did you have any comments, too? I don't know if you knew him, but...
Yes, I actually was around in the legislature when Hector McPherson and actually my predecessor, Ted Halleck, who carried the bill in the Senate, collaborated along with, of course, the then Governor Tom McCall. It really was groundbreaking. It was landmark legislation, and as a reporter for AP, I actually covered the adoption of the rules for DLCD that formed DLCD they called them. I used to know this the. Articles or something, the goals, as they adopted the goals. Yes. And I remember at that time, my coverage of the goals focused on the energy conservation goal, which is almost unheard of now, but energy conservation was the real issue at the time because we were in an energy crisis. And then as years went by, of course, the interaction between the rural areas, the farmland protection, the forest land protection really became dominant, as I found out when I did serve on LCDC. And for a while, I actually had the honor of serving with Hector McPherson on LCDC. I thought it was a great wrap-up for his career in land use to be able to actually serve on the commission that was born because of his work. So. He was just a class act. I saw him as a legislator. I saw him as a LCDC member. And I also saw him as an advocate sitting right where you all are sitting, arguing passionately for agricultural land and for the farming economy and for the farming way of life. So it was a true honor.
Well, great. That I had no idea that you had such a personal connection with him, too. So I think many people knew him. And Senator Betsy Johnson told me that her father, when he was a legislator, actually served in the legislature with Senator McPherson. Okay, well, we are in a work session. Senator Ferrioli?
Madam Chair, I move SCR 17 to the floor with the be adopted recommendation.
Senator Ferrioli has moved Senate Concurrent Resolution 17 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. And Senator Burdick, you know, since you actually served with Hector McPherson, I think you would be a great carrier on the floor, and I'm sure there are others who would like to add comments too, but would you be willing to be our carrier?
Well, thank you. I definitely did not want to displace Senator Gilser because she's the chief sponsor. But if
we'll ask her if she wants to co-carry with you, but I think you would be a great carrier.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, and I will close the work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 17. And I think that brings us to our one remaining bill since we carried over House Bill 2655. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill. No? So I already carried over House Bill 2655.
You did.
Yes.
Yeah. So
832 is a work session for invited testimony.
Right. Right. I know it's not ready to work.
Right.
We don't have the paperwork.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. So I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 832A. And this is scheduled today for the purpose of taking testimony because we don't have all the paperwork. So, Sandy, would you tell us what this is?
Sure. Senate Bill 832A requires the Oregon Health Authority to set standards for the coordinated care organizations to integrate delivery of mental health services with the physical health services. It defines integrated behavioral health care, permits the use of appropriate billing codes by the mental health providers at integrated location. It has an emergency clause effective on passage. You have an A6 amendment, and I believe that's what our two individuals are going to walk the committee through. And those, would you like to call them up or?
Yeah, so we have two people here to testify. I think it's Robin Henderson and Cheryl Ramirez, if you'd both like to come forward. And while you're getting settled, I realized now that I am looking that we have two committee members missing and that we're not going to be able to move this today anyway because we still are waiting for the fiscal impact statement to come back. You might want to just briefly explain these amendments and then we'll ask you to come back on Tuesday at our next hearing when we carry this over, if you can, or if one of you can come back so that the two members who will probably be here then will get to hear the explanation too. So I don't want you to have to spend too long explaining this twice.
Thank you. Senator Rosenbaum and members of the committee, my name is Robin Henderson. I'm with St. Charles Health System and also with the Oregon Psychological Association. We bring you Senate Bill 832, which brings together the integration of mental health and physical health care in primary care and behavioral health home settings. We have worked very hard with the Oregon Health Authority, the Association of County Mental Health Professionals, the other licensed health professionals, and many, many other folks throughout Oregon to bring forward a bill that sets some standards and definitions for the practice of integrated health care. Basically, what this amendment does is bring in what Cheryl will talk about in terms of behavioral health homes, so I won't steal your thunder, okay? You got it. All right. But this is really very much landmark legislation. There aren't places in the country that have combined this integration of physical health and behavioral health in a bidirectional fashion that we can find. There are places that reference integrated health care or may reference behavioral health homes, but to bring them both together in one piece of legislation is very new and very different. part of what brought us to this point was in the work we've done with coordinated care organizations in the Medicaid population and the realization that access to health care comes in a lot of different ways. Sometimes folks will come in through the door of primary care. Sometimes they'll come in through the door of a community mental health program. Sometimes they'll come in through the door of an emergency department. But health care happens in a lot of different places, and we need to change our language and our statutes and the way that we bill for and provide care to support people getting care in the place that they come in the way they wish to receive it. So what this bill and these amendments will basically do are set the standards for some definitions of a behavioral health clinician as a licensed provider for whom mental health is within their scope of practice, set some definitions for what are called other care team members that Cheryl will talk about more that are very integral to the provision of whole person care that's integrated, and also set standards for the definition of what integrated health care is. And integrated health care really has been around as a concept since probably prior to 1996, but in 1996, that's when the Institute of Medicine really began to recognize that this was a very important thing that we needed to address. And this really talks about how you treat the whole person, their mental health, substance use, physical health, social determinants of health, and all the other things that impact their health. This bill will set forward, set in motion the ability for CCOs to begin to work with the health authority and develop the rules and infrastructure so that we can fully develop these programs to support the transformation of healthcare in Oregon. So I appreciate you hearing it today in rules.
Thank you. I'm pleased to go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. I'm Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 832A. I thought the dash 5 amendments, I didn't know there was a dash 6 amendment actually, unless that's just a change from and to or, then we're good with that. I didn't know that was going to be a separate amendment. Okay, thank you. We support bidirectional integrated care. Robin explained it very well, both in person-centered primary care homes and behavioral health homes. And I just wanted to, I sent in a longer written testimony, but I just wanted to share a couple of highlights. We believe behavioral health homes are an important alternative health care setting for people with chronic and complex mental health and substance use disorders. And we were coming up with an estimate of how many people we think could benefit from being in a behavioral health home. We believe that's about 15% of the total Medicaid population, which is 90,000 people in Oregon. If we were to take a really conservative estimate, maybe half of that, or 45,000 people, would be enrolled in behavioral health homes. And that's quite a substantial number of people, and that's more than likely a higher cost population, too. Secondly, just wanted to make it known, I guess this is an opportunity to share some information, too, about the current community mental health system. People with mental health and substance use disorders do receive services from both licensed and unlicensed behavioral health providers. I've detailed some differences between the licensed and unlicensed qualified mental health professionals, as well as the important roles of unlicensed qualified mental health associates and peer support specialists. They play a very central role in the recovery continuum of care for people with mental health and substance use disorders because they have lived experiences, they've been through it. Third, as you may know, we have a significant behavioral health workforce shortage in Oregon, and so we need all hands on deck, so to speak. So that means teams of licensed medical and behavioral health providers, as well as unlicensed providers, to successfully integrate care for those individuals to help improve their health and quality of life. And then lastly, I'd just like to share a story, a very short story, about my brother-in-law, Fernie. Fernie has lived with schizophrenia since adolescence, and he didn't have a very, very great life. He wasn't able to work. He wasn't able to do a lot of things that people do in their lives. He smoked a lot to cope with his mental illness and probably out of boredom because he didn't have a lot going on. He was addicted to alcohol, and that was quite a problem for him in his adolescence and as a young adult. In his later years, he didn't have a whole lot of access to alcohol, so that wasn't a problem. Fernie would go regularly to a psychiatrist, but he would not go to a primary care physician. He didn't go to the dentist. So he had terrible problems with his teeth, and he had physical health problems that he just never, there was never anything done about it. It wasn't until a few weeks ago that he finally went to a primary care physician because he must have had horrific stomach pain. When he went to the doctor admitted him to the hospital immediately because it was so acute. It turns out he had a huge mass in his pancreas that was blocking his intestine. His organs shut down within 3 days, and he died. He was 58. Fernie's just another statistic in this. You may have heard this, that people with serious mental illness die on an average 25 years younger than the rest of the population, and he fits right into that statistic. If Fernie had gotten earlier primary care treatment, you know, maybe he still would have died of a chronic physical condition, but maybe he would have had a better life, a longer life, and a less gruesome end than he had. So I'm using this example because, again, Fernie didn't die of his schizophrenia. He died of a physical health issue. And so for people like Fernie, behavioral health home is the best fit, because then they would get physical health care too when they go to their psychiatrist or other behavioral health provider. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to promote behavioral health homes as an alternative for people like Fernie. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you both for your testimony. And I see now, looking at your testimony, that it looks like you both traveled some distance to get here today. So, or maybe
not me, Chair Rosenbaum.
But you did, Robert.
I did.
Right.
Thank you,
so Rosenbaum. We won't expect you to come back from Bend if that's where you're headed back to. We'll make sure that the other committee members get a look at your written testimony. And sorry, I'm extremely sorry for your loss. And I think almost everybody I know, including myself, has somebody with serious mental illness in their family, and just the impact of a loss like that is enormous. And I think the bill does present some changes that can really help people get the care that they need and get it sooner. So
thank you, Chair
Rosenbaum, for telling your story. Any questions or comments, members? Okay, well, thank you both again for your testimony. Yeah. And did we have anyone else to sign up on? Anyone else signed up to testify on Senate Bill 832? No. Okay. So we will close. Well, actually, I'll just carry over the work session on Senate Bill 832 to our next hearing. And that completes our agenda for today, members. And so with nothing further to come before us, we are adjourned. Thank you.